What men are these, of what great race, from what old shire or town, that rush so valiantly to face death and a deathless renown? That short poem was published in a book written by a man called W.H. Holloway, who was the editor of the local newspaper here in Northampton during the First World War. And he wrote a book called Northamptonshire and the Great War, 1914 to 1918. And it's a source that so many of the stories that I'll be telling in this series of podcasts about the story of the 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment. It's a source, as I say, that I'll be using on a regular basis to share the information that had long been forgotten about those ordinary men from a typical town in Middle England. Yes, it's about Northamptonshire, but it could be any town that raised those Powell's battalions in the summer and autumn of 1914. The 6th Battalion of the North Ants was typical of any of those, which is why I chose them. And during this series of podcasts, we're following their story from enlistment and recruitment. That was featured in the first episode a couple of weeks ago. And this week in the podcast, Tales on the Battlefields with me, Terry Wenham, we're going to follow their story down to Shoreham in Sussex on the south coast of England, where they begin their training. And then we'll follow their route to East Anglia, to Colchester in Essex, where their training continued. This week's episode is going to follow them through that basic training from September of 1914 to July of 1915. What were the conditions they experienced? Why was it such a shock to their system when they discovered that they had nothing to eat their food with, no utensils? They didn't even have a cup to drink with. We'll listen to the story through their words. And back in Northampton, what was happening there? We'll find out what happened in September of 1914, when a train load of Belgian refugees turned up, how the people of Northampton turned out to help them and to feed them and to give them drinks and sweets and help them on their way to their eventual destination. We'll hear their story. And for the first time, we're going to meet Colonel George Ripley, the man that was recalled from retirement to be the first commanding officer of the battalion. How did he find non-commissioned officers from the ranks? Who was he? And we're going to discover how those volunteers from Northampton kept themselves amused in between being trained to fight the German foe. And we find out how Ripley became so annoyed with them for some of the practical jokes they carried out on each other that he punished them. What was all that about? Well, as I say, we'll find out, not through the history books, but through the voices of the men themselves. This is what the podcast is all about. So before we go any further, I think we ought to find out a little bit more about what it was like going off to that camp and doing your basic training, and who better to tell us. Ross Morris, if you remember from the first episode, had enlisted, he'd come from Kettering and he'd enlisted at Northampton Barracks. And we now pick up the story as he begins his basic training. And we listen to the words spoken by Ross himself in an interview with the Imperial War Museum, I think during the 1960s.
Just built tents. They pushed them in there in the middle of the night. Now, that was the beginning of the camp, you see, a new one, just put up. Of course, we're in our own civvy clothes. And the Salvation Army tent there was a good tent because the fellas used to eat the rations at breakfast time, all the rations all day. Then they gradually got Nissen huts going, you see. And we still got our own clothes. And that's, we got a blue forage cap. That was the first bit of uniform we had. And when we went in the rain, all the dye came out and ran down our face. Then we got the blue suits, and one day went on the route march to Portland. We got halfway to Portland, a terrific rainstorm came, and we had to turn back, and the rain went down our backs into our boots, and all the dye came off our hats, and we had no other clothes. We had to sit in the huts 3 days to get them dry. We just wore a blanket. We just used gymnastics in the morning and all like that, and route marches, and rifle practice, and parade practice, all like that, you know. Then we went by train to Colchester. Well, we went through proper discipline then, you know, marching and all like that, getting ready to go to France there. And we were there, I was there about 3 months, and then we went to Raynham in Kent. That's where you started from France there. You got kitted up at Raynham.
Private 14530 Ross Morris. So the army order, which officially brought the first new army into existence on the 21st of August 1914, it actually laid down a 6-month syllabus of training for men in the infantry and also the artillery and the engineers. And recruit training for the infantry was to cover a period of 10 weeks with an average of 8 hours a day. In the first fortnight, the recruits were to receive preliminary instruction in musketry and elementary squad drill, and would start to learn such basic military procedures like saluting officers and standing to attention. They had to form a straight line on parade, turning by numbers and wheeling from line into a column of fours for route marches on the roads. The extended order drill and night work would be introduced in the 3rd week, route marching in the 4th week, outpost duties in the 5th week, and then they would do entrenching and bayonet fighting in the 7th and 9th weeks. And within their battalion, they would be divided into companies and platoons and sections. And a platoon drill would begin in the 10th week, 6 hours each week, would be devoted to physical training, getting these men fit. And then after 3 months, during which time the men were expected to complete the recruit's musketry course, company training was to commence and continue for another 5 weeks. And then at this juncture, some men were selected for specialist training as machine gunners, grenade throwers, bombers, that means, and scouts. And in signalling, in Ross's case, he was chosen to be a signaller. And by the 5th month, the troops were ready to graduate to training at battalion and brigade strength with field days, more entrenching schemes and extended route marches comprising a major part of the syllabus. And then in the final stages of the programme, they would then join the division for exercises and route marches, which sometimes would last 2 or 3 days at a time. And by this time, the soldiers were hardened men, hopefully, much stronger, physically stronger, bonded with their mates and ready to take on the Germans. Now, while this training is going on, back in Northampton, life is changing for the civilians. One of those changes sees the arrivals of Belgian refugees. These entire families had been forcibly evicted from their homes by the Germans, where in many cases they'd chosen to leave in the wake of the German advance surging through their country. But the problem with housing Belgian refugees here in Northampton was that there was no official financial arrangement system in place, as there was with the billeting of troops that came here to Northampton. And local housewives were paid quite a lot of money to billet soldiers from especially Wales, which we're going to look at another time here in Northampton, but not the Belgians. But nevertheless, many individuals and organisations came forward and providing help and support for these people from Belgium. And there was an appeal fund that was set up in October of 1914, and within a few weeks, it had raised £74, 16 shillings and 1 pence. And that's quite a lot of money in 1914. And then many local people came forward. They offered their homes to these Belgian people. There was a Mr. Finnegan. He placed a large house at their disposal in Colwyn Road. And another man, Mr. Rawlinson from Colwyn Road Laundry, carried out all of their washing free of charge. Now, not all of the Belgians that came to Northampton stayed for a long, prolonged period. Many were only in the town for a very short time, sometimes only 30 minutes, because the trains were taking on coal and water as they were on their way to places like Glasgow. But this didn't stop local people from offering their support. And I found this article in the local newspaper, which gives a report on what happened one day when one of those trains stopped here in Northampton. Northampton Independent, 24th October 1914. Two trainloads of Belgian refugees passed through Northampton on Friday last on their way to Glasgow, where they were to find rest and refuge far from the horrible scenes of carnage, destruction and German brutality from which they have escaped. Each train made a halt of about an hour at Northampton, and the poor homeless mortals were entertained to the best that Northampton could provide under the circumstances. There was food in plenty, gallons of coffee, huge boxes of sandwiches, baskets of cake and warm milk for the children. There was, for many of the homeless travellers have had nothing to eat since they entered the train. To see their eyes light up at the good things provided made the many helpers happy in the knowledge they had secured the men, women and children of a plucky little country whose resistance to the German bully had brought so much suffering upon themselves, yet saved others from a similar fate. The plight of the travellers was heart-rending. Many possessed nothing more than they stood up in. Some had only slippers on their feet. One poor woman with four little children had lost her husband, and many were the tales of sorrow and distress that they told. In helping them, one felt that a privilege had been granted. There was not a man or woman amongst those who were on the platform who did not part with some little souvenir and receive one in return. Many of the helpers bought chocolate for the women and children and cigarettes for the men, and as the laden trains steamed out of the station, rang with the cry "Vive l'Anglais" from hundreds of throats. You can't help really to be moved by those words in that article. Just try and imagine those people completely taken by surprise, having to leave their homes in such a hurry. And by the end of the Great War, a quarter of a million Belgian refugees had come to the United Kingdom. And at the end of the war, the government offered them free return travel to their native land. And in less than 12 months, 90% of the refugees had returned home to Belgium. But of course, those that came from places like Ypres would return to just piles of rubble. But now, turning back to the training of those men and of the 6th Battalion, and it's off to Shorncliffe they go. Private 14597 F.B. Howell of A Company, we mentioned him at the barracks in the first episode a couple of weeks ago, and he said off to Shorncliffe they went, 8 to a tent. There were no cups, basins, knives or forks or anything else. However, two of our more enterprising mates did manage to obtain a toilet jerry, which we were able to get our tents ration of stew or tea when the Dixies came round. All meals were eaten in our tents, and by scrounging the camp dustbins, we were able to get an empty condensed milk tin each to serve as cups. It was some 2 weeks before we were issued with eating utensils, by which time I was able to eat anything. During the latter part of October, the severe gales blew down the various marquees of the camp, and we were transferred to Colchester. Now, in this exercise book, this unpublished account that I'm using, written by a man called Peter Jackson, written in 1975, he says it became clear from the above statements given by the survivors themselves that whilst by no stretch of the imagination could Shorncliffe be described as the birthplace of the 6th Battalion, it most certainly was. It was their nursery ground, and conditions varied from camp to camp. These, after all, only serving as glorified reception centres where men were formed into sections and companies in preparation for the more serious business of training that would follow later. There was a private, A. Young, he said, on arrival at the camp, which was under canvas, we were issued with a number of oddments, but no uniforms, but nevertheless it was a good camp. But on the other hand, Sergeant Keatley, he disagreed. He said we arrived just after sunset on Saturday, September the 5th, to find no facilities whatsoever for our reception. Conditions were bad, provision being totally inadequate to deal with the number of drafts pouring in. The local barracks was overcrowded and we had nowhere to sleep. Tents were procured and we got the job of erection. Sleeping accommodation was provided by using the shingled floor as a spring mattress, and the small pebbles made sleep well nigh impossible. By 3 a.m, most of us were taking a constitutional along the front. No cups were available for the partaking of liquids, but this difficulty was overcome by purchasing tins of fruit from the nearby town and making use of the empty tins. All in all, it was not exactly the warm welcome we had expected. So within a few weeks, off they went to Colchester. But they did then have a solid roof over their heads, but the standard of comfort didn't really improve. And there was a statement again from Private F.B. Howe. He says, on arrival at Colchester, we were again placed in tents, but with the heavy rains, we were soon flooded out of these and placed into wooden huts that were in the course of erection. There was no doors or windows fitted, and being November, we were feeling the draught. The only uniform we had consisted of the civilian clothes in which we had joined up, and by now these were so shabby that the army issued us with civilian overcoats for our camp wear, so as not to offend the locals. About the middle of December, we were issued with navy blue uniforms and given the generous grant of 7 shillings and 6 pence for the use of our own clothes. It wasn't long before those huts were fitted with doors and windows. They were given wooden trestle beds, made their life a bit more comfortable, and slowly but surely the 6th Battalion was starting to feel a little bit more like soldiers. Now, it was in the early weeks following the outbreak of the war that Colonel George Ripley, a retired officer of the regiment who'd seen active service in South Africa, was recalled. He became the first officer to command the 6th Battalion. When he arrived, he found only a few NCOs, most of them like himself, had been recalled from retirement to train this new army, and there was virtually no officers. And these problems he quickly overcame by the simple act of appointing any man he could find as an NCO, as a corporal, lance corporal, or a sergeant that had been a member of the Boy Scouts, the Boys Brigade, the Church Lads Brigade, or any organisation, really, that had some idea of how to parade, I suppose. And whilst in the case of officers, commission ranks were offered to any man who'd been a member of the public school officer training corps or perhaps served in a territorial unit. But without uniforms, how they were going to distinguish NCOs from other ranks? And someone came up with the idea of having white arm tapes for corporals and red for the use of sergeants. There was a Captain E.F. Stokes. He said, "I was a schoolmaster with no military experience save membership of the Cambridge University Officer Training Corps. But I found myself on Colonel Ripley's nomination a second lieutenant of his battalion at Colchester." Now, perhaps wasn't a perfect way of selection, but the writer of this book that I'm reading from, Peter Jackson, he said that when he interviewed all of the veterans from the 6th Battalion, not one of them had nothing but wonderful compliments to make about Ripley himself and also the officers and those first NCOs. Northampton Independent, 5th of December 1914. A letter from Sergeant Frank Leatherland, son of Inspector Leatherland of the Borough Police, says that the battalion which is stationed at Colchester is having a good time and the men who have attained a gratifying degree of efficiency are eager for serious work in France or indeed Germany. Sergeants Aylett and Leader were clerks in the employment of the Northamptonshire County Council. Northampton Independent, 19th of December 1914. A poem. We asked them to fight our battles. We asked, and we asked not in vain. They bravely went forth then to fight them for honour and glory, not gain. We honoured them when they were going, shall honour them when they come back. Let us show that we honour them always by sending them something they lack. Northampton, remember your soldiers. Remember your soldiers and pray that they may have something to think of to remind them of Christmas Day. If we went to those rain-sodden trenches and we asked what they'd like on that day, they would tell us they didn't want nothing, but on second thoughts possibly say, we're fighting for freedom and honour. We're as happy can be. We're having the time of our lives to because we're fighting for England, you see. We sit and wait here in the trenches, in mud and in these dirty rags. We don't want no pity nor cheering, but for goodness sake, send us some fags. So who was that man that the men loved so much? Lieutenant Colonel George Eustace Ripley. He was born in 1864, the third son of Canon Ripley of Earlham Hall in Norfolk, in the east of England, and he was educated at Rugby School. He became a professional soldier, initially with the 3rd Battalion of the Norfolk Regiment, but then his connection with Northamptonshire began in 1889 when he joined the 1st Battalion of the North Ants. He was promoted to captain in November of 1892, and then joining the 2nd Battalion saw active service in the war, the Boer War in South Africa. And he took part in several battles there, and he was mentioned in dispatches in 1901. Meanwhile, before that, in 1896, he'd married a lady called Violet, and they moved to Berry House in the village of Cottingham, which is near Corby. He then served as the adjutant to the 1st Volunteer Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment, and then he was promoted to Lieutenant Colonel and their commanding officer in 1903. And of course, by this time, the Boer War is over and we're back in peace. And he continued in command of this battalion as an honorary colonel from 1905 until it was rebuilt or reorganised as the 4th Territorial Battalion, the TA, in 1908. But reluctantly, now aged 50, he had to retire from army service just a few months before the declaration of war, and having spent his entire career in the military, he must have wondered what he was going to do with himself. But then, of course, August 1914 comes along. He's 50 years old, war's declared, and he applied to be reinstated. He wanted to go back to lead that territorial unit, the 4th. But instead, they said that with a man of his experience, they needed someone to govern and lead this new army battalion, the 6th. And he was given command of it in October. And it was George that led them through their training, and it was him that took them over to the Western Front in July of 1915. But we haven't got that far yet. Our journey now takes us to Colchester. And this is where the 6th Battalion really got down to the job of preparing for war, the basic training that we talked about in the previous episode. As day followed day, training was escalated by every possible means, and amongst other things, the commission ranks and the NCOs were no longer addressed as Mr. From now on, men had to call them Corporal, Sergeant or Sir. Drill and more drill, physical training, parades, route marches, inspections and musketry were all entered into with a keenness and enthusiasm that would have astonished the most hardened veteran. This is it, isn't it? This is those pals, this is what they joined up for. They're doing this together with their mates. There's probably a sense of competition coming in here as well to see who could be the best. And in this book that I'm reading, this Peter Jackson unpublished book, it says the one fear felt by everyone at this time is that the battalion might not get to France before it was all over. Incredibly, isn't it? It still seems incredible that they still thought, even with what had happened on the Western Front, that this war was going to be over by Christmas. Now, one of the other challenges that the men had, of course, was the stresses and worries of being away from home for the first time. And it got too much for one man, John Edward Howlett, a private in the 6th North Ants, because whilst they were down at Colchester, he decided that without permission, he wanted to return home to Brigstock, a village near Kettering in Northamptonshire, because he'd heard news that his brother, who'd been away for 6 years serving with the regular British Army, had been wounded in those first battles. So he went home to see his brother. But he hadn't got permission, and therefore this was desertion. And he was arrested by Superintendent Tebby. And he discovered that Howlett had asked permission from his commanding officer. Perhaps that was George Ripley himself for permission to return home to visit his brother. But permission was refused, so he decided to go anyway. He was remanded in custody, escort was sent up from Colchester, and he was returned. Doesn't say whether he actually got to see his brother. Let's hope he did. Now, Howlett survived the war, and not only that, he was wounded on the 1st of July 1916, as we'll see in future episodes, as the Northamptonshires carried out a successful attack near the village of Mametz. And not only that, but he was awarded the Military Medal for his actions on that day. A far cry from a year earlier, when he found himself in trouble for returning home without permission. But by this time, tragically, the battalion had had their first two deaths, both caused by disease. Death by disease in the young, of course, was very common 100 years ago, but it still must have come as a shock to the lads when they lost their first two comrades. The first of those to go was a young man from the village of Denton, a farm labourer. His name was Fred Minney, and he was just 18 years old. All we know about him is that he died of disease in Colchester Hospital. He was in the isolation unit, and his body was returned to the village of Denton, just on the edge of Northampton, where he's buried beneath the Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone. That was on the 28th of February 1915. And then just 3 weeks later, on the 18th of March 1915, another man died, Private Arthur William Trayford, and he was from Kingscliff, near Peterborough. His body wasn't returned home. He's buried in the Colchester Cemetery, and his family chose an inscription for his headstone that says, "Gone but not forgotten." We know a little bit more about what happened to him because I found his pension card in the archives, which are held by the Western Front Association, and it tells us that he died of meningitis. I've also found a record on Ancestry that has been placed there by a family member. And there's an article published in the Essex Newman newspaper on the 20th of March 1915, 2 days after he died. And it says the death occurred early on Thursday morning at the Colchester Military Hospital of Private Arthur William Trayford of the 6th North Ants. The deceased was suddenly attacked with diarrhoea on the previous night, was at once removed to the hospital. And in another newspaper article, I've got a report here of his military funeral. It says the funeral of Private Trayford, who died somewhat suddenly in the garrison hospital in Colchester on Thursday, took place on Saturday with four military honours. The polished elm coffin was covered with the Union Jack, upon which rested the deceased's cap, belt and bayonet, and was borne to the grave on a gun carriage horsed by the Royal Field Artillery. The cortege was preceded by the band, firing party and buglers of the battalion and was followed by the mourners, including the deceased's father, mother and brother, and by nearly 200 non-commissioned officers and men of the North Ants. At the ceremony, the usual three volleys were fired and the last post sounded. Wreaths were sent by Mr. and Mrs. Trayford, the deceased brother and the officers of the 6th North Ants. Goes on to tell us that he was in the 11th platoon within D Company. But the training must go on, and indeed it did. With all that marching going on, the women back home were worried about the men's feet, and a lady called Elsie Willows from Kettering wrote a letter in July of 1915 to the local paper, the Mercury. She said, "May I appeal through your paper for socks for the 6th North Ants? They are most urgently needed. The men are undergoing strenuous training with long marches, and consequently their socks soon wear out. Most of us know how uncomfortable it is to walk even a few miles with a potato in our stocking heel, gradually getting larger and larger. So what must it be like to march 20 miles in the broiling sun with socks full of holes?" By potato, I think she means a blister. As this is one of our county regiments and is commanded by Colonel Ripley and has many local men in the ranks, I'm sure there will be a ready response, particularly when one thinks that each pair sent be a comfort to the brave lad who is doing his duty for his country. Any kind of socks are acceptable, provided they are not too thin. And if sent to me, I will at once forward to Captain Willows for distribution in the regiment. Now, as I read that in my mind's eye, I can just imagine the women folk back home wanting to do something to help, getting their wool and their knitting needles out and going to work to help supply those men and help them as they prepare for the unknown journey ahead. Another family from a village near Kettering, the village of Bullock, had sent five of their sons off to war. And the father, Mr. Harry Dolby, had received a letter from His Majesty the King because he'd discovered that Harry had got five sons serving in the army. But even by this time, the eldest of them had died. Arthur Dolby, serving with the Seven Leicesters, was another one of those that had died of disease while training in Aldershot. But two of his sons, Guy and Sidney, were serving with the Sixth. The letter from the keeper of the Privy Purse, F.M. Ponsonby, said this: "Sir, I am commanded by the King to convey to you an expression of His Majesty's appreciation of the patriotic spirit which has prompted your five sons to give their services to the army. The King was much gratified to hear of the manner in which they have so rapidly responded to the call of their sovereign and their country, and I am to express to you and to them His Majesty's congratulations on having contributed in so full a measure to the great cause for which all the people of the British Empire are so bravely fighting. I have the honour to be, sir, your obedient servant." Although no doubt mourning the loss of Arthur, Harry must have felt so proud to receive that letter, mustn't he? It's dated July the 3rd, 1915, just a few weeks before Guy and Sidney set off for the Western Front. And the good news is, those four lads, including the two from the 6th North Ants, they all returned home. There's no record of their deaths on the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website. But what those men didn't know was that as they said goodbye to their first two lost comrades, that over the course of the next 3.5 years, over 1,200 more of them would not be returning home. That's more than, of course, the battalion strength at that stage. As these original volunteers went off, they became casualties. They were to be replaced by more volunteers and then conscripts. Almost three completely different armies made up the 6th North Ants. But let's see what happened next. And sport, too, was not forgotten. And neither was it confined to the great outdoors. Our man, Private F.B. Howe, that we've spoken about before, he says, "In general, the six were a friendly crowd, all sorts and sizes, although one chap in particular who shared our hut, well, he was somewhat different. He was older than the rest of us and had previous service. He went to bed one night, and as he was late coming in, we decided to play a little joke on him. We therefore tied a cord to his trestle bed in such a manner that when he got into it, if the cord was pulled, the bed would collapse. As I myself with his opposite number, it fell to me to pull the cord. However, he came in drunk and in a very bad temper, so that when the cord was finally pulled and he finished up on the floor, he didn't see the funny side of it as we did. Staggering to his feet, he traced the source of the trouble to me, and crossing the room, he placed both hands around my neck and he began to squeeze. I came very near to passing out before my comrades managed to pull him off. We learnt later that he'd served 5 years for manslaughter. Nevertheless, I'm glad to be able to relate that the spirit of true sportsmanship so prevalent amongst all ranks of the British Army prevailed, and we finished up the best of friends. I last saw him in naval uniform in Chatham in the year 1918. He told me that whilst on leave from France, feeling fed up with the army, he'd reported back to the Navy as a deserter. It only remains for me to say that the Navy welcomed him back with open arms, for such is life." Now, frustratingly, Howe doesn't actually tell us who that soldier was. I'd love to find out a little bit more about him, but I don't think I'm going to be able to. Now, there's another example here of some foolish behaviour, which was punished by Colonel Ripley when he returned from a period of leave. Older people will remember in the 1960s and 70s, there was a phase or a fad, I can't think what the word is now, of people having their heads shaved. They became known as skinheads. And this was what they did whilst Ripley was, as I say, on leave. During his absence, some wag put it about that it was necessary for all ranks to have an all-off haircut, and so everybody did, including the officers. When the colonel returned, he was absolutely furious, so he stopped further leave for the whole battalion as a punishment. Then, finally, the greatest day of all arrived up to now anyway, when the much sought-after kit arrived, the suits of khaki and equipment was issued. Then they had to work out how to fit the buckle into the strap and make a size 9 shoe fit into a size 8 foot. But they felt pride. That pride was felt by everyone in the battalion when the battalion turned out for the first time on parade in their new uniform. With the introduction of rifles, the range with live ammunition, it became a great attraction, and this new innovation, coupled with the already heavy training schedule, made life, if anything, just a little hectic for these men from Northampton. Things were really progressing now. February 1915, one of the battalions in the division, the Royal Sussex, became a pioneer battalion, and they were replaced by the 7th Bedfordshires. So now the brigade was made up of just four battalions, the 6th North Ants, the 7th Beds, the 11th Royal Fusiliers and the 12th Middlesex. And this formation was retained for most of the war. And as we heard earlier from Ross, now they'd got their full equipment, they could do route marches in full pack, and they marched between 25 and 30 miles from Colchester via Ipswich and Woodbridge to a place called Hollisley Bay. And when Jackson wrote this book in 1975, over 60 years later, he says there were still some amongst the survivors of the battalion who can vividly remember every yard of that, he says, never-to-be-forgotten march. The rolling milestones, the blistered hill, the spirit of army comradeship as one travelled the road, covering 25 to 30 miles each day. The pride of achievement as packs were discarded at the end of it all, and the welcome relaxation in the cool of the evening. These things they remember. Yet the one thing that takes precedence over all these memories is the rollicking, roaring chorus of the song that cheered them on their way. A song that they made up, and they called it Hollisley Bay. Hold your row, hold your row. We ain't said a word about half what's occurred. Hold your row, what do you say? We learn some new swear words at Hollisley Bay. I love that. On the 19th of March, with the rest of the brigade, the battalion undertook their first ceremonial inspection. And it was carried out by a man called Sir Archibald Murray. He was the chief of the Imperial General Staff, and it was held in a blinding snowstorm with a bitter cold wind. But despite all this, all went well, and on the 15th of May, they entered a team for the Southern Cross Country Championship, which was an 8-mile event. There were 25 military teams, consisting of 20 runners each. The first 10 runners home in each team scored points, and the 6th Battalion finished in third position, and each of the scorers received a medal. And there was a photograph taken afterwards which included both Ripley and his second in command. Also, in the early part of May, the battalion proceeded by road to Hertford, just north of London, a march that occupied some 3 days. And from there, they went on to Codford on Salisbury Plain. Here, the final stages of preparation for war began, and the intensive field training undertaken, and it made life more strenuous than ever, and not to the extent that sport was excluded, because on the 29th of May, the battalion entered into the Brigade Cross Country Run. This was held on the plain itself. There were 2,000 starters, and each member battalion of the brigade fielded around 500 men each. That's about half the battalions then. It was a gruelling race, contained all the usual spills and thrills of these occasions, and it was the 7th Bedfordshire that came out on top. They won, and the 6th Battalion came in second. Now then, the men were getting impatient. They really wanted to get over to the war. And it meant, incredibly, that some of them were chosen to go to see the senior officers with requests that they were given a firm date. I don't know what they were going to do if senior command told them to clear off. But what they didn't know was that the anxiety and stress of the long weeks of training was coming to an end. Daily route marches of up to 18 miles per day in full pack have been common practice now for some time. And at one stage, they were inspected by none other than His Majesty King George V. And the battalion took this as their cue. They knew that they were on the verge of moving across to the Western Front. The last week of July, at long last, the eagerly awaited orders for service overseas arrived. And as Private J.C. Panter tells us, we left Codford and proceeded to Warminster, in training there for Southampton. Here we boarded the troop ship and landed at Boulogne on the 26th of July 1915. I well remember as we marched over the cobbled incline from the ship, our regimental band playing the Marseillaise. So after 10 long months that at times had seemed to last forever, trained to the hilt, fit, healthy and ready to come to grips with the enemy, the 6th Battalion landed in France. It was the beginning of an adventure that was to last for a little over 3 years, an adventure that was to lead to both death and to glory, and to carve one more niche in the hall of fame of that mother town, the town of Northampton. Now, I don't know about you, but I've often wondered how those men felt when they made that journey. So many times when we go by ferry across from Dover to Calais, heading to the Western Front, I look back at those white cliffs of Dover and I think about those men from Northampton. I think about my own great uncle Henry and my grandfather that made the same journey. And I wonder what was going through their mind. Were they afraid? Well, let's see what Ross has to say, shall we?
There's one thing was peculiar to me. As soon as they went in France, I never felt afraid in the battle or anything. I never felt afraid at all.
So that's it for this week. Thank you for joining me on this journey with the 6 North Ants. And the next time we pick up their story, they'll be over on the Western Front in France. But we leave this week with perhaps a song that was in their minds, not just them, but soldiers from subsequent battles and another war, as back home someone was keeping those home fires burning.
They were summoned from the hillside, they were called in from the glen, and the country found them ready at the stirring call for men. Let no tears add to their hardship as the soldiers pass along.